Hi everyone, it's Gavin Jay, the best thing since autumn, and you're listening to The Therapy Suite right here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. This week I speak to Dr. Sam Baddington, an early years qualification specialist and young and family wellbeing researcher. Dr. Baddington, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi Gavin, thank you so much for inviting me along today. I'm doing great, thank you. Yourself?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. I think it'd be great for you to tell us a bit about yourself and, you know, how you got to where you are today. You can start how many years back is up to you.
Absolutely. I mean, so I'm actually the founder of a professional body called the Association of Child and Family Coaches, which I'll go into a little bit more detail about later. But that's all sort of come from me in terms of both research, but also personal lived experiences. So I will start with that sort of element of lived experience. So I grew up as a child who experienced both trauma and abuse. And for a long time as a child, I didn't have the words to explain to others what I was going through. I didn't know at the time because, you know, I was a child in sort of the 90s, but I was also neurodivergent and I've been diagnosed ADHD as an adult. So I was also at the same time processing the world differently from other children around me, which often meant that adults misunderstood my silence or behaviours as well. As I got older, I realised that I could, you know, have made the biggest difference, or the biggest difference that was made to me, should I say, was a consistent adult who saw me for me and not just my reactions. And that's what's driven what my work is now, and that is helping other people, both professionals but also parents, to understand that behind every behavior is a story. So my mission in the work that I do is to make sure that no child ever feels unseen or unsafe the way that I once did.
Thank you for sharing all that with us. We much appreciate that. And it's really interesting to hear how, you know, you got to where you are and what kind of pushed you, well, motivated you really to get here. You spent your career championing trauma-informed practice. What first inspired your passion for safeguarding and supporting children and families in this way?
So trauma-informed practice is very much, you know, when people think of trauma, when we say the word trauma, people automatically think the worst, you know, someone's been abused in the worst possible way. But actually, trauma looks very different for everybody. So a family who are going through, for example, a diagnosis for their child for neurodivergence, let's say they think their child is autistic and they need support, that whole journey to that family is a trauma. And what again is a trauma is, let's say they have waited for 4 to 6 years for the diagnosis to come through. And what happens at the end is they get handed a leaflet and say, here you go, that's the information you're going to get. That in itself is a trauma. So it's really, really important that we have an understanding of trauma in every element of practice that we do. So all practitioners, whether they work in the early years, whether they work in schools, whether they work in health, have to have an understanding of that trauma-informed element. And that really, you know, supports the work that I do. Because early trauma leaves an imprint on the brain and the body. And if we look at a child who's living through trauma, they end up with fear or unpredictability. The nervous system adapts so that it can survive. The child ends up staying on high alert. They scan for danger. And over time, this can end up affecting different things like sleep, memory, trust, the immune system. And I look back at myself and I see, even in myself growing up, I had that constant sort of anxiousness, anxiety, struggling to regulate my own emotions, and always ready to be on that sort of, you know, in fight or flight mode, ready to flee from a situation. But the wonderful thing about the brain is the ability to heal through safety and connection and consistent care. So relationships are, you know, and the antidote to trauma. And that is why trauma-informed practice is so important, because we can rebuild safety and rewire that brain so that it looks towards, you know, hope, a hopeful future.
Absolutely. And I think it's, what you're saying makes total sense, because it's down to us to kind of, to the people around the child, to try and identify it. Because unfortunately, the child might be so young, do you know what I mean? They can't themselves, they see things as normal. Whatever's happened to them is all like normalized, isn't it? So it's down to the practitioners or the people who are working with the children, whoever it is, to try and identify that, so that you can start to work with that child.
Absolutely. I mean, we always say, don't we, that safeguarding is everyone's responsibility. That is something that is sort of drummed into us as practitioners, as professionals. But honestly, there's still, that's just, it seems to be just something that we say and we talk about, but actually, is that happening? So when I present on stage, I present something called a piece called The Hidden Child. And I start my presentations with a few pictures, slideshows, and we'll see people like Baby P and Victoria Climby. And people know who they are, but their tragedies have already happened, and that informs our practice. I then show a picture of a little girl, a photograph of a little girl who no one will recognise. And I wait for them to say who they think it is. And before I get no answers, of course, I say, that child is me. That child is someone who was abused, but they were missed. And then I say to them, the NSPCC says that 1 in 8 children are sexually abused. 1 in 8, exactly that reaction, those eyes, 1 in 8 children are sexually abused.
That's a lot, you know.
And that's not just, not abuse across all the spectrum, that is sexual abuse. So I think for practitioners and all of us professionals, the biggest gap is that confidence. And sometimes, the compassion for ourselves as professionals as well. We really do care deeply, but we're afraid of getting it wrong. And there lies the problem. So safeguarding training often focuses on procedure, which is, of course, essential. But it can often overlook that sort of emotional element and reflective practice that goes with it. So we need to create environments where professionals feel really safe to ask questions, challenge assumptions, and keep learning. And we mustn't forget that safeguarding isn't just about spotting harm. It's actually about preventing it. And we need to do that by making sure that we've got connection, curiosity, and a safe culture for our practitioners to talk to each other within.
Absolutely. Can you explain the CALM approach, as in connect, acknowledge, listen, move forward, and how it's transforming the way educators and carers respond to children in distress?
Absolutely. So I'm a researcher, as you know, hence the doctor title, and that, I keep researching. I absolutely love researching. Education was always sort of my safe space. When I was growing up, although I wasn't great in school academically, it was my safe space because I was away from the home. And then as I grew up, it was my safe space for my mind, because it allowed me to keep thinking and keep moving and keep going. And something that I'm currently working on and researching on and will be publishing sort of early next year is something called the CALM approach. And the CALM approach has grown out of both research and also real experience. So CALM, which is connect, acknowledge, listen, and move forward. So connect is about safety. Okay, before we teach, correct, or guide, we must connect emotionally. And that's very much related to resilience, really, as well, and also self-regulation. We talk a lot in practice about helping children to regulate their emotions, but us as adults can't help a child to regulate until we've regulated ourselves. So that's really something that's important. Acknowledge means validating the child's feelings, even if we don't understand their behaviour. So we often talk about behaviour being a communication, and we need to acknowledge that the child is showing a feeling. And even if we don't agree with or understand or know what that feeling is or why it's connected to how they're feeling that way, we still must validate it. We must say that we, you know, we understand and we're here to help you. Listen. Listen is deeper hearing. So it's noticing the clues in play, in children's tone, and also their energy as well. So it's really showing that we're understanding how their patterns are. So we're ready to spot those changes when something, you know, might be going amiss. And then finally is move forward. And this is about helping them to regulate and to repair rather than sort of punishing them or dismissing the behavior. So for children who've experienced trauma or who are neurodivergent, for example, this approach can actually be life-changing because it tells them you're safe, you're understood, and we can talk through this together.
Absolutely. We often hear about trauma in later life, but how does early trauma shape a child's emotional and physical health as they grow?
Oh, of course, absolutely. So early trauma, as I mentioned sort of earlier, it leaves that imprint on the brain. And the child, if they are living in fear or in an unpredictable environment, the nervous system will adapt and it will put itself into a survival mode. And that really does impact a child's immune system. And as I sort of mentioned earlier, their sleep, their memory, everything about that child is different because they're reacting. And the nervous system, and there's a lot of more recent research on neuroscience, as you're aware, as we're all aware, with everything to do with neurodivergence as well. But the trauma element is the fact that the nervous system is changing to make sure that it can survive and flee. But what that means is that a child will struggle to regulate their emotions because they're just waiting for the negative thing to happen. So they can't be calm and, you know, just be able to be a child and feel free. They've got to be on the edge of ready to run at all times. So it really is about finding those connections so that, you know, the emotional and physical health can start to rebuild and redevelop.
Safeguarding is everyone's responsibility, as you mentioned a bit earlier, but you mentioned not everyone feels equipped to do it. Mm-hmm. What are the common gaps you see in awareness of training across sectors?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I sort of mentioned earlier, I think that we need the space to be able to talk with each other. It needs to be safe for the professionals. And when I sort of mention the figures that the NSPCC give, the reactions are very much like the eyebrow raise that you gave earlier when I shared the figures. 1 in 8 children sexually abused, which is astonishing and awful. And I think that when we have that safeguard in training, we look at it as the event has already happened. So we look at children that we know from the media and we say, how are we going to change in the future? And we don't really think about, actually, if we've got 8 children in our group, one of those at least is being sexually abused. If we've got 18 children in our class, at least 2 of those being sexually abused, we are not learning to spot the patterns right there and then. We're not thinking about the children in our classrooms. We're thinking about the children in the media. We should never forget the children in the media, ever. Never forget them. But we must also not be taken away from the children who are directly in our care at the time. And we need to ensure that we remain curious, professionally curious, about all of our children at all times, because it's not just about spotting harm, as I said earlier, it's about preventing it. And we can only prevent it if we really know our children. And our practitioners and our professionals need to be in a culture to feel safe to be able to report it as well.
Are there signs of a child... I'm just trying to explain, I just want to get this right. Are there signs people can look out for to see how a child presents themselves when they're in whatever environment it might be in, which gives the indication that they've experienced some kind of abuse.
Absolutely. And this is where the professional curiosity comes from. So you will have children who will present in certain ways all of the time. And that is where you might start by looking at neurodivergence nowadays as a start point anyway. Back when I was younger, it was less looked into, there was less understanding of it. But that was also the same with safeguarding and abuse as well. You know, so these two things are really important to understand together, because what you may find is that other children who don't usually present in those ways start to show changes in their behaviours, and that's what you will spot first. So a professional who is curious and is connected with the child will start to see and spot patterns and changes in the behaviours. In terms of children who present as neurodivergent and their behaviours are often consistent, you may see changes in their levels of frustration that they may show, the dysregulation. But also, it's really important to note that a child who is neurodivergent is also more susceptible to abuse as well. So when spotting the signs, it really is about knowing the children that you're working with. So that professional curiosity that I mentioned is hugely, hugely important.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we're just going to a quick ad break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Dr. Bennington, thanks for that information you've given us, an introduction into the topic. You talk a lot about the power of play as communication. Can you share an example of how play can help children process difficult emotions or experiences?
Absolutely. So play is something that's really close to my heart, and it's also informed the CALM framework that I spoke about earlier. But as a child, a lot of children would create a whole world out of toys, out of the things they had. And those worlds were safe. They were safe worlds where the rules made sense to the child. From a personal perspective, I didn't realize it at the time, but it was my way of making sense of the chaos of the world around me, of what was happening. But in my professional work, I've seen other children do the same. So a child might use figures to replay an argument that they've seen at home, or bury objects away to show what's been hidden or lost. So play lets children externalize what's too big to hold on into the inside. So play isn't just about fun, which of course is really important. We all need to have fun. We all need to play. But play is also a form of therapy for themselves. It's a form of communication, and it's also a form of healing, all rolled into one as well.
Mm-hmm. Your frameworks bring psychology, education, and well-being together. Why do you think a holistic approach is so vital in the early years?
You can't actually separate the mind from the body or learning from emotion. I think when we talk to doctors and health professionals and things like that, you'll often get a line saying, if you try and think positively, it will help your body. Okay. And to an extent, that really is true. You can't separate the mind and the body. And you can't, separate learning from emotion. So when I was young, for example, being neurodivergent meant I was often labelled as distracted or sensitive. And often, I remember this one very much, a dolly daydreamer. Okay. But in reality, what was going on in a classroom in the 90s, where neurodivergence wasn't even known about, what was happening was really I was overwhelmed and I was dysregulated. So when we approach children in a holistic manner, considering all of their needs, so their sensory needs, their emotional world, and their relationships, everything changes. So a child who feels safe and they feel regulated, they can play, they can learn, they can connect. So that holistic approach really is a human-centered education, and that's what all children deserve.
Absolutely. What are some methods used to help children who have been abused?
It's very much dependent on the child that you're working with. So children often will want to use a sensory element, okay, because they don't often want to say exactly what's happened, especially young children who don't know how to sort of tell you what's happened. And you'll want to use things that the child enjoys to play with, to do. So lots of painting, lots of drawing, and lots of other sensory sort of materials as well. Because in the world where everything feels calm, feels comfortable, they're able to communicate a lot more freely with you as the practitioner who is taking, who is supporting them to understand those emotions. It's important to have those sensory elements for them because that also helps the regulation. I didn't have the opportunity to tell somebody my story as a child. So when I was an adult, when I told my story, it was in a safe environment, but I was completely and utterly dysregulated because I had to sort of say it and try and communicate that as an adult, that this awful thing had happened to me. And I think that when we bring in play and when we bring in that sort of safe space of trust, that is really what changes. So it really does depend on the child. You need to get to know the child you're working with, what they love to do, and you'll be able to allow them to express themselves through those methods.
I'm guessing the response depends on the child's age as well, doesn't it? So I totally take on board that sensory methods might be used. As the child gets a bit older, are there other methods that are used as well?
There absolutely are. And again, it very much depends on the children that you're working with. So some of the work that I support my trainee coaches to do is working with adolescents, so older children. And an example that I have from one of my trainee coaches, he was working I think the lad was 13 years old. He was in residential care. And he found it really difficult to communicate the experiences that he had to his support worker. So I worked with the support worker to look at methods he would like. And the boy showed an interest in the support worker's interest in golf. So he took the boy out to play golf, and which was great. You know, the fact that he'd shown an interest as well was amazing, and that is a breakthrough in itself. But he wanted to communicate through this play. So the support worker saw that the boy was really struggling to hit the ball playing golf. So what he did, the support worker drew smiley faces on the balls and said, "This person is this individual in your life. Those were representative of the different people that were around this child. So when a child is in care of some kind, they have a lot of individuals who work with them. And the boy was able to swing and hit the ball. The support worker got to one particular ball and said, "This ball represents this person." Okay. And he popped it on the tee for the boy to take the swing. And the boy said, "I can't hit that ball." And the support worker said, "Why can't you hit that ball?" "Because that person means too much to me and they've made such a difference to me in my life." And that is a really, really good example of how it's so personalized. Play and communication is so personalized. That boy was able to express at that point through his play, which was individual to him, how somebody else made them feel and how other people made them feel. He was able to hit certain balls because those people he felt weren't supportive, but he wasn't able to hit another ball, which meant that the support worker could go on and work really closely with the individual he didn't hit with the tee, if you like, so that he could move forward and they could develop strong connections together.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Basically, digital learning is growing part of early education and childhood. What opportunities and risks does it present for safeguarding and emotional well-being?
Mm-hmm. So digital learning, obviously, we can see that is growing everywhere. My own children, for example, I've put them into 3D games design classes because I think that there's important skills to be learned. But digital learning really can open incredible doors, especially for neurodivergent children who find comfort in structure, in visuals and creative tools. It allows accessibility and choice, but we also have to recognise the risks. Overexposure is often talked about, social isolation, and the lack of those sort of real-time emotional cues as well. So the key is co-engagement. Adults, therefore, learning with the children, so guiding those digital experiences rather than leaving them alone to it. You know, children sitting with iPads alone for hours on end, you know, technology should extend connection rather than replace it. And that's where we've got to find the balance.
Absolutely. Through your work with the Association of Child and Family Coaches, how are you helping raise professional standards and consistency across the sector?
Okay. So the association came from a vision to professionalize a field that is often fragmented. So therapeutic coaching, for example, coaching, counseling, and so on, they are unregulated sectors. Okay. We can have professional bodies, and I would fully recommend that people who want to work in this field ensure they join an appropriate professional body, ensure that they have an ethical framework, make sure that they're insured, and so on. Before the Association of Child and Family Coaches, there were several coaching organisations that coaches could join once they were fully trained, ethically trained, safely trained. However, a lot of them focused on executive coaching or life coaching and so on. So I wanted to create a home for practitioners who shared my belief in compassion, ethics, trauma-informed care. So at the association, we provide sort of the accredited training that they need, the continuous professional development, but more than that, it's a community. So our coaches have their own lived experiences of trauma more often than not. They might be neurodivergent themselves, or have come through a parenting challenge. And we believe those stories are the strengths when combined with professional training, because together, the lived experiences and the safe ethical training build, you know, outstanding, ethical, trauma-informed, therapeutic coaches to work with children and help them through.
Absolutely. I'm guessing training is used as well. Would that be right, to try and improve professional standards and consistency across the sectors?
Training is so important, but training needs to be right. Okay. we see a lot of adverts on Facebook and things like that for £29 courses, and you do a tick list sort of quiz at the end, and it says that you are now a child and family coach, a play coach, a play therapist or something like that. This is not the case. This is not safe practice at all. Training needs to be ethical. It needs to meet standards. It needs to be extremely comprehensive. We are going on to work with children and families who have, you know, potentially presented trauma. They need support to move forward. There's neurodivergences in place. You can't rely on these little courses with a quiz at the end. It needs to be full portfolios of supervised training so that you can use your own lived experiences, which really, really matter. And that's a key element of the model of the association. Lived experiences matter, but you need safe and ethical training to go alongside it. Without that, you should not be in practice at all.
So there are training sessions out there, but some of them are not actually adequate. Is that right,
basically? I would absolutely say that. And it's really important that people who are interested in going through a career to support children and families, that they really make sure that they're getting a high level of training. It follows an ethical framework. It covers safeguarding. It covers, child psychology, child development, working and communicating with parents and families effectively. And, you know, it's rooted in ethical practice and safe practice. If you're not producing a portfolio of evidence, if you're not working towards, you know, case studies, and if you're not being supervised and not presenting a final, you know, sort of case piece and casework, then you really shouldn't be signed off as somebody who should be working with children and young people in that way.
Where do people find the right training?
Training is available anywhere, but I obviously am going to say that the best training to come to for me is that the Association of Child and Family Coaches, because what I've built is exactly what I've just said. Okay, it really is. It's built in ethics. It's built in trauma-informed care. It's also accredited by in other industry bodies as well as our own. You know, I'm not going to go out there right now and say that our courses are accredited by my own accrediting body, because I want to show people that other accrediting bodies are willing to accredit too. So the ACCPH and the Association of Coaches, for example. But not just that, they're also approved by UK awarding bodies as well, which means they've gone through full standards. They have to be internally quality assured, externally quality assured. Everything really needs to have high standards, and that is what the potential learners need to be looking for in their training courses.
Brilliant.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, let's go to a quick ad break. I think that's a good idea. So, Dr. Bennington, thank you very much for everything you've been talking to us about. It's a wealth of information that's come out of this. What can parents and practitioners do when they suspect a child is struggling emotionally but can't express it in words?
So children will often sort of demonstrate that they are struggling through their behaviours, and that is sometimes what we see often in, you know, in the playground, for example, or in the street. You see parents and the children having a little bit of an argument because the child can't express themselves properly. But what we really need to look at is start by, you know, observing the child with compassion. So in practice, we observe that child. We need to notice any patterns, so changes in play, in eating habits, in their sleep, and also their tone as well. And you need to sort of approach the child gently. So I can see you're feeling something big, okay? That's what you need to say to them. And you need to let them know you're there for them. So simply say, I'm here. And you want to avoid pressure to make them talk, because they can't express to you in words what they're feeling. So instead, you need to sort of create a safe, predictable space where they can express their feelings as much as possible. So as an example, for some neurodivergent children, visual supports, sensory play, as I sort of mentioned earlier as well, or movement might help more than sort of the direct questions. And if something feels off, practitioners should always seek advice from other professionals as well, whether that's internally or if it's externally, and getting that advice. Because intervention early, so as soon as you spot that emotional struggling is happening, really can make all the difference for that child as they go forward.
The people that you've worked with, what do they say are the most common signs that a child shows regarding? And I know it might differ from abuse to abuse, because, you know, it's not that straightforward. But what are some of the most common signs that are shown?
It's definitely how they are showing those big behaviours. When I talk about big behaviours, I'm talking about what some people might call tantrums. It's not a word I like to use, but tantrums is a word that people would understand what I mean when I'm talking about big behaviours. So if you're looking at sort of changes in those behavioural patterns, they're sort of starting to have more tantrums. They are really dysregulated, unable to tell you how they're feeling, and they're expressing it in ways that you would say are incorrect behaviours, if you like, whether that's simply, you know, knocking other children's towers down, or, you know, throwing a paddy in the middle. You know, it's sort of anything that is not the normal behaviour. They are trying to express basically what's happened. A child has become dysregulated because everything is going on in their mind so much, so strong, and they've been unable to express it because they don't know the words how to. And something really, really small can trigger that outburst as well. And they're the signs you've got to spot at the end of the day. Yeah.
And often, as you mentioned earlier, any type of behaviour actually is a form of communication, isn't it?
Absolutely is. Any type of behaviour is a form of communication. So one of the things that I say to people is, we talk often about this dysregulated behaviour and those big behaviours, but it's something we also need to spot is the opposite end of the scale, and that is when a child becomes silent and doesn't show anything. And I think sometimes that's so easy to miss. So a child who's normally, you know, quite active, quite engaged, if they've gone quiet, if they've started acting more quiet, if they've sort of eased themselves into the background, that's also a behaviour that we need to spot. That is a form of communication to tell us that something's not quite right.
Because I was actually going to ask, is there a type of communication which is actually more low level, basically, which is that, and you answered that. It's very, very interesting to hear that, you know. So, you know, finally, what's your hope for the next decade of early years in education, and what changes would make the biggest differences to the well-being of children and families?
So I think that my hope for the next decade would be to bring more humanity into education, where emotional safety and inclusion are the foundation for every classroom. I really hope that that happens, you know. I'd love to see trauma-informed training embedded across schools and in early year settings, so that every practitioner, every teacher, every professional feels confident in supporting children's emotional worlds. We need more reflective supervision for educators. I was speaking to a group of my coaches who are on one of my trainings this morning, and we had a shared discussion. A lot of them work in schools, and they don't conduct reflective practice in the same way as they would if they were actually out performing their coaching practice, or if they were counselling. They don't have the opportunity to do it. So I think we need to have those supervision sessions for educators, because better understanding of neurodiversity as well, and systems that nurture our children rather than exhaust them. And that is the same for the practitioners as well. Systems that nurture the practitioners rather than exhaust them. And ultimately, I want a world where no child feels invisible, and where adults are given the support that they need, so to help them be calm and steady and be present for every child, because every child deserves that.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time today. It's been very, very interesting. If people want to touch base with you a bit more about what you do, and if they want support or anything like that, are they able to do that?
Absolutely, and please do. So I've got a few places that I can be reached. So if you're on LinkedIn, you can find me Dr. Sam Ballington, Ballington. You can also find the Association of Child and Family Coaches on Facebook, and also childandfamilycoaching.org on the internet. And that's the best places to come and find me, to reach me, and you'll be able to contact me. I'm open to all of those routes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. Much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you to our listeners. Thank you so much. You know where you can find me, at Gavin J417 on Instagram. Until next time, take care.